So here the address by our guest speaker, Dr. J. E. Shelley, now of Brisbane, who will speak on the case against evolution. As it has been advertised, this meeting has been jointly sponsored by the Evolution Protest Movement and the Hobart branch of the Bible Union of Australia. Now, very few people know about this Evolution Protest Movement, so if you will grant me your indulgence, I shall give you some of the details in connection with it. Now, this movement was founded so late as 1932 by Captain Bernard Ackworth, VSO, RN of the Royal Navy, in conjunction with Sir Ambrose Fleming, who was the first president. Now, Sir Ambrose Fleming was the eminent scientist whose invention of the thermionic valve made wireless telephony possible. Our present president is Sir Cecil G. Wakeley, Baronet. There are a whole host of letters after his name, I shall spare you that. But he's a very eminent physician and scientist and past president of the Royal College of Surgeons. There is a very distinguished list of past presidents and vice presidents, all eminent men in their profession. And most of the sciences are represented here, so anyone associating with us need not be afraid that he's associating with a pseudo-scientific movement whose claims cannot stand up to scrutiny. Now, this particulate I have of this pamphlet here says that the evolution protest movement is a scientific, religious, and educational organization which is unsectarian, non-political, and non-profit-making. We are disposing of all our books in the hall at cost. Non-profit-making. We have no paid officers. All services are voluntarily given. The objects for which the movement is established are to advance the United Kingdom and elsewhere the evangelical Christian faith, and in particular to achieve this object by refuting any attacks made upon the veracity of the Holy Bible, especially those arising out of the theory of organic evolution. And the aims are to publish and distribute books and pamphlets demonstrating that the theory of organic evolution is not in accordance with scientific facts. To show that evolutionary teaching causes a decline in morality and true Christianity. And lastly, to supply scientific information supporting the Bible statements on creation as opposed to the widely accepted views on evolution. I would stress at this stage this is an entirely non-sectarian movement. Amongst the writers of the books and pamphlets that we disseminate are members of the Church of England, the Roman Catholic Church, the Seventh-day Adventist Conference, Christadelphians, Presbyterians, Baptists, and so on. And the reason why they are able to work together so harmoniously is that their common meeting ground is science. Science. And we feel that it's on the ground of the natural sciences that we must combat this theory. That is why tomorrow night there will be a dialogue between Dr. Shelley here and Mr. M.R. Banks, B.Sc., who is Senior Lecturer in Geology in the University of Tasmania. Then you will be able to hear opposing views. We cannot be fairer than this. As I told Mr. Banks, we are starting this movement in Hobart, and we do not want the charge leveled at us that we are totally one-sided and that we are giving a wrong impression of our opponents. So you can see this is an evidence of our genuineness. Now, with me on the platform here tonight are several of the members of the Hobart branch of the Bible Union of Australia. Now, this is not a religious meeting, this is a scientific meeting. But they are here because they respect the Bible. They respect the Bible, as I'm sure many of you here do, if not all of you. But they're not only here on scriptural grounds. I would quote a few lines from a statement by Professor W.R. Thomson, the Fellow of the Royal Society, the distinguished director of the Commonwealth Institute of Biological Control at Ottawa. He said, and I quote, these are his words, the words not of a theologian, but of a biologist, the doctrine of evolution by natural selection, as Darwin formulated, and as his followers still explain it, has a strong anti-religious flavor. And that is why I have the support of the Hobart branch of the Bible Union of Australia. But I would stress, ladies and gentlemen, that the Bible Union and the evolution protest movement are two entirely distinct and separate bodies. The Bible Union is an interdenominational body. Their main interest is scripture. The evolution protest movement is a non-denominational body, and their main interest is science. So do not confuse these two bodies. But both bodies endeavor to show on purely scientific grounds that the doctrine of creation is in accordance with science, that the doctrine of evolution is not in accordance with science. Well, now, if you are in sympathy with our movement, then we would ask you to join it and thus give it support. As you leave at the door, you will find ushers who will have forms to enable you to join. You can complete these forms, and the annual subscription fee is 5 shillings. That is little enough. And for that, you will get a quarterly gazette showing you the latest advancements in science that conflict with this theory of evolution. You may give your 5 shillings, if you so desire, either to the ushers, or you can send them, together with the completed form, to our postal box, GPO Box A44J Hobart. The address is given on those membership forms. And also on the table there, just outside, are various books and pamphlets that our evolutionary protest movement have published. The range is only very small as distributed, but the leaflet I have here shows that to date we have published over 150 books, leaflets and pamphlets written by persons of the highest scientific eminence, which show that the theory of evolution is not in accordance with science, and that its groundwork is guesswork. Well, Dr. Shelley will tell you more about that in a moment. We're selling those books at cost because we're not a money-making proposition. And if you're interested in any of these other publications, just write and let us know, or tell any of us who are about the door, and we will see that you are given the latest literature. Also, I might briefly mention at the door, there are a couple of places to receive voluntary contributions. Now, we advertise that admission is free, and we mean it, and we're not here to make money, but if any of you would like to give us practical support, merely to defray the expenses of advertising and the hire of the town hall for tonight and tomorrow night, well, we should be glad of your support. But we would stress it is voluntary. Now, just before introducing the doctor here, I would let you know the form of this meeting. As soon as I've introduced the doctor, he will give his lecture. on the case against evolution, and that will last for about an hour. At the end of his address, there will be an interval of about 10 minutes, so that those who have to go home early may do so. The meeting will convene again after the interval of 10 minutes, and the rest of the evening, up to 10 o'clock at the latest, will be devoted to question time. And anybody in this hall is at liberty to pose questions to the doctor, but they will be written questions for the sake of brevity and clarity. Well now, it is my pleasurable duty to introduce Dr. Shelley. I believe you do not have to look at him very long to realize that he is a soldier. He is a soldier. Yes, he is a fighting man. Not every soldier is a fighting man, but Dr. Shelley is a soldier and a fighting man. And he's still fighting. No longer fighting for King George as he did in Palestine in World War I when he was medical officer of the 9th Light Horse Regiment. But he is now enrolled under the banner of the King of Kings. And we read in the Bible that there is no discharge in that war. We need those fighting men in Hobart. And Dr. Shelley has come all the way to Brisbane to give us that lead. Now, Dr. Shelley is a much traveled man. I do not think that there is one place mentioned in all the Bible that he has not either visited or seen. And when he talks of these skeletons that these evolutionists drag out of their ancestral cupboards to endeavor to show us that we climbed the ancestral tree, well, he's not only seen pictures of them or replicas of them, he's actually seen them in the various museums around the world. So therefore, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I introduce to you a Christian soldier who will now give you the case against evolution, Dr. Joseph Shelley, late captain and medical officer, 1st AIF, 9th Light Horse Regiment. Dr. Shelley.
Friends, I may be a soldier. I have been a soldier. And I'm sorry to say the only medal I won in the war was for doing the fastest time in the 110-yard hurdles after the war was over. So that when I came back, my nephew asked, "What did you do in the Great War?" I said, "I won a medal." And he looked at me and said, "But this is for running." I said, "It's the only one I won." So that I don't know about very much about it, but I was a soldier, of course. I was in the 9th Light Horse. I was in Jerusalem the day Allenby entered it, December the 11th, 1917. And I stayed in the Near East till 1960. I was 44 years in the Near East, 20 years in Jerusalem, or 22 years in Jerusalem, 22 years in Cyprus, a hot spot. And so, friends, Mr. Woolenizer is not wrong. I have been in these places, and I have visited pretty well every Bible site, Nineveh, Kali, and all these places. It's quite easy over there if you stay there a long time, and it's very, very interesting, and gives you a great respect for the Bible. Now, before we begin, actually, my talk, friends, I should like to read here a paragraph from this book. The introduction to this book. It will give you the purpose of our lecture. I will tell you who it's by and what the book is in a minute. "As we know," says this scientist, "there is a great divergence of opinion amongst biologists, not only about the causes of evolution, but even about the actual process. This divergence exists because the evidence is unsatisfactory and does not permit any certain conclusion. It is therefore right and proper to draw attention of the non-scientific public to the disagreements about evolution. But some recent remarks of evolutionists show that they think this is unreasonable. This situation where scientific men rally to the defense of a doctrine they are unable to define scientifically, much less to demonstrate this scientific rigor, attempting to maintain its credit with the public by the suppression of criticism and the elimination of difficulties, is abnormal and undesirable in science. We are here, therefore, friends, on the advice of this scientist, it is right and proper to draw attention to the non-scientific public to the disagreements about evolution. And that paragraph was taken from Professor W.R. Thompson's Introduction to Darwin's Origin of Species. We are here to speak about evolution, friends, and I've no doubt you've noticed that most people will say, I accept or reject evolution without having the slightest idea of what it is or what it teaches. Also, their ideas vary so greatly that it might almost be said, tot opiniones, tot homines, tot opiniones. So many men, so many evolutionists. But we must have the definition, therefore, of the acknowledged authorities. And I take this one from the 13th edition of the British Encyclopedia. It's Professor Sully's authoritative definition. He says, evolution is the modern doctrine as opposed to creation and is defined as a natural history of the cosmos, that is the universe, including organic beings, expressed in physical terms as a mechanical process. And he expands that definition just below in these words. In the modern doctrine of evolution, the cosmic system appears as a natural product of elementary matter and its laws. Now, in case you should think that this definition is outdated and too inclusive, we would include in our paper the definition of Sir Julian Huxley, writing in Evolution and Genetics, Chapter 4, 8, page 72, and dated 1955. He extends it even farther, saying, our present knowledge forces us to the view that the whole of reality is evolution, a single process of self-transformation. This macroevolution, therefore, includes, as stated, organic evolution, which can be described as a theory according to which life arose as the interplay of the blind forces of nature, or by the fortuitous concourse of atoms, that is, chance, and gradually developed from simple or rudimentary forms to the complex form of man. So evolution, friends, is extended into universal principle, accounting for the whole universe, the galaxies, the nebula, the stars, the solar system, the plants, the animals, and man, both body and soul. And even to God himself. For you notice there's no mention of God in these definitions, none at all. The process is a purely mechanical one with no place for the deity in it. Indeed, Sir Julian Huxley asserts that God is fading out of the picture like the Cheshire Cat. He is not needed anymore. So if this theory is correct, friends, you and I are but totally unimportant units in a herd of slightly modified beasts, without God, and without hope in the world. It's a dispiriting and degrading conclusion, because to deny the existence of God is to deprive man of his spiritual nature and to degrade him to the level of the beast. Dispiriting and degrading. Please do not think that this dismal hypothesis is new, modern, or scientific. The Greek philosophers held it 500 years before Christ. For example, Epicurus in B.C. 300 in physics attributed all nature to changes amongst atoms themselves eternal, and he did not recognize a creator. Sir Julian Huxley is an Epicurean, for he said, in conclusion, we have the glorious paradox that this purposeless mechanism, after 1,000 million years of automatic operations, has finally created purpose as one of the attributes of our species. His conclusion, plainly stated, means that the marvellous forms of life and the almost infinite adjustments and contrivances of inanimate nature are due to chance. If you can believe that, friends, you can believe in it. Blaise Pascal, the great French scientist and thinker, said 300 years ago, there is nothing more impossible to believe than that matter can know itself. But apparently believers in the continuity of nature, that's evolutionists, can achieve the impossible. For it is suggested by Dr. D.F. Lawton in Nature, April the 25th, 1964, that even subatomic particles must exhibit some level of consciousness. He goes on to suggest that the electrical and gravitational characteristics of a fundamental particle are those of its mental qualities, which it presents to an external observer. Friends, meet Mr. Proton, Mrs. Proton, and the Miss Protons. This is the reductio ad absurdum, if ever there was, of the continuity theory, that even the subatomic and particles must exhibit some limit of consciousness. We creationists have no need to be ashamed of our belief that the ultimate reality is an all-wise, all-powerful, eternal spirit, God himself, the great I Am. There is nothing absurd or degrading about that belief. It elevates man's whole being, spirit, mind, and body. The evolution theory, friends, had sunk for many centuries into a well-deserved obscurity that it was resuscitated by Darwin, Wallace, and others about 110 years ago. It has now obtained almost universal acceptance. You ask why? Is it because it has been most clearly observed to occur and is supported by experiments and scientific evidence? That is what most people believe, but it is not true. And the most vigorous and vocal adherents of the theory admit it. The great high priest, Kirk Coote in his book calls them archbishops, of this faith before Sir Julian Huxley arose to take his place was Sir Arthur Keith. Sir Arthur, who has the merit of being honest about this matter, said long ago, evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it because the only alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable. By the way, it's not very scientific, is it, to dismiss a theory, a possible theory, because you do not like it? One of the minor prophets of this devil's gospel, not my phrase, Darwin, in a lecture to T.H. Huxley, dated August the 8th, 1860. One of the minor prophets of this devil's gospel, Darwin's own phrase, Professor D.M.S. Watson confirmed this dictum when he said in Johannesburg in 1929, "We maintain this theory not because it has been observed to occur or is supported by logically coherent arguments, but because the only alternative, special creation, is unthinkable." So you see, men, and don't forget, friends, I've been addressing soldiers all my life, so is that men do not wish to think about or believe in creation because that involves thinking about God, the Creator. Special creation means, of course, that he made all things and sustains them by the word of his power. And that, of course, makes us responsible to give an account of ourselves to God, a very humbling thought to proud man. Well, you say, Doctor, that may be the true reason why this theory is so popular, but what are your reasons for believing it is not the process by which all things came to be as they are? Before I begin this section, friends, and here I would ask you to give very close attention this discussion, may I remind you of our authoritative definition. In the modern doctrine of evolution, the cosmic system appears as a natural product of elementary matter and its laws. Since this definition teaches that the cosmos is the product of matter's laws, it is well to consider what we mean by the term law. What is law, or a law? It is simply a rule prescribing a course of conduct or action. A law is not an efficient agent or force. It can of itself do nothing. A law of nature affects nothing. The law of gravitation never moved a planet any more than the laws of navigation ever steered a ship. A law or law implies an agent and a power, for it is the mode according to which an agent proceeds, it is the order according to which the power acts. Hence we infer that the intelligence by which the law is ordained and the power by which it is put into action must be present at all times and in all places where the effects of the law occur. So the wisdom and power of God pervade every portion of his universe, for we observe the same laws, his laws, being carried out into everywhere in it. The heavens declare the glory of God, says the psalmist, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Newton realized the truth of this, and asserted that the forces posited in his law were not occult or spiritual, but their causes were. And Betts, if we must be up to date, remarks, after all, what causes the curvature of space-time and in the neighborhood of matter? We know the answer. My first objection to this so-called universal principle is that it does not account for the origin of matter and energy. Evolutionists, as a rule, refuse to discuss the origin of matter and energy from which chance is supposed to have developed the whole universe. J.B.S. Haldane, in his debate with Dewar and Davis, refused to discuss this. They want to begin the discussion or description of evolution with all the matter and energy already in existence. We refuse to allow this. They said that evolution explains everything there is, that it's all reality. We're not giving anything, or given this or given that in this discussion. We're starting with nothing. And this reminds me of an incident told by a doctor, one of my profession, Dr. Cronin. He had brought a professor of biology to explain evolution to a boys' class in London. I have lived in London, and these Cockneys are no fools. So the professor began by telling them that countless billions of years ago, there was no life in the world, just a vast, wild ocean churning up the rocks and sand by ungovernable waves. Wave after wave of this vast ocean beat upon the shore, grinding up the dead elements in the rocks and mixing them together, and until at last the slime, or soup, happened to contain just the right compounds to produce one living animal, an amoeba. And that was how it all began. When he had finished, he asked in a very condescending and pompous manner if any boy would like to ask a question. One boy, who stuttered somewhat, raised his hands, and he would like to ask a question. Well, my boy, he said, what is it? What we like to know, sir, is where did all that water come from? That's what we want to know, and evolution can't tell us. Some of the less instructed evolutionists will say that matter is eternal and has always existed. The most antiquated assertion. Popular with the Epicureans and Stoics 2,300 years ago, but discredited today, matter is not eternal.
is continually breaking down into simpler forms and finally into radiant energy. If matter were eternal, thorium would long ago deteriorate into radium, radium into lead, and all the stars would have burned out. Professor Whittaker, late president of the Royal Society, says, all cosmologies must take into consideration the fact of creation not so many millenniums ago. And Sir James Jeans, in his EOS, or the wider aspects of cosmogony, says everything points to a definite event of creation not many millenniums ago. So evolution fails to account for the existence of matter. Again, the theory of evolution is flatly against the two most fundamental and firmly established laws of physics. The first and second law of thermodynamics. The first law is that of the conservation of matter and energy. It lays down that there is no creation of matter and energy going on today. You can change the form of matter, but you can neither increase its quantity nor decrease it. To avoid this difficulty, Professors Hoyle and Bondi have invented the theory of continuous creation. That is, that somewhere in the universe, matter is being created out of nothing. There's absolutely no observational or experimental basis for this totally unscientific theory. Even many uniformitarian scientists are appalled at the presumption of Hoyle and his colleagues in proposing such a theory in the name of science. I give you the name here, Professor McVitie, head of the University of Illinois. He writes thus in his book, Rationalism versus Empiricism in Cosmology, volume 133, April 1961. But more than this, Professor Martin Ryle of Cambridge produced experimental evidence before the Royal Astronomical Society of Great Britain in 1961, which showed that this theory fails to fit the facts. Reported by the Observer, I have a copy of it, on Sunday, February the 12th, 1961, thus, the central cosmological argument is settled. The universe is not eternal. It was born at a definite time in the past and is likely to die. So since natural forces are not created, they are the result of pre-existing forces and must act as they do, some supernatural force, which can act or not as it pleases, must have been at work to bring the universe into existence. The supernatural force that did the work, friends, is God. The first verse of the Bible is strictly in accordance with true science. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Or as Hebrew puts it, by faith we understand that the worlds, note the plural, were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen are not made of the things which do appear. And the second law of thermodynamics is also flatly contradictory to evolution of any kind. This states, of course, that all things left to themselves get into disorder and degenerate. It is a fact that complex systems of matter are breaking down into simpler forms, and as we said before, the universe is a clock that is running down. Evolution says that systems and matter are being built up from the simple to the complex. Science flatly denies it. The second law of thermodynamics is supreme amongst the laws of nature, says Eddington, in The Nature of the Physical World. He also says if your theory is against the second law of thermodynamics, and evolution is, I can give you no hope. And Bridgman, in his Reflections on Thermodynamics and the American Scientist, says, the second law of thermodynamics always wins in the end. So please do not call this theory a scientific one. It is against the laws of nature which evolutionists themselves invoke. Then, friends, evolution does not explain the origin of life. When Darwin put forward his theory that life began as a very simple one-celled organism, practically nothing was known about the stature of a cell. It was thought that because a living cell is small, it was therefore simple. Nothing could be farther from the truth. It was therefore fairly easy in those days to put over the idea that from dead, inorganic elements, by some lucky chance, a cell might be formed. But cells are formed of protein, the most complex substance known to man. In the simplest beef insulin molecule, there are 777 atoms, carbon 250, hydrogen 377, nitrogen 65, oxygen 65, and sulfur 6, all combined in the most intricate compounds such as amino acids. And there are 100,000 kinds of protein in the human body. The probability against even one protein molecule just happening is not 100 to 1 against, it is 100 multiplied by 10, 160 times. Well, even then these proteins are dead, completely dead, and only when the spirit of life breathes upon them can these dry bones live. Is the cell simple? Listen to this. One human cell, less than 1/1000th of an inch in diameter, contains thousands of enzyme molecules, protoplasm, cell walls, and here I would say as a note, friends, that the cell wall of these cell is only 4 molecules thick, yet it has the property of admitting useful substances and refusing harmful ones, though it's only 4 molecules thick. But to go on, it also contains genes, chromosomes, hundreds of protein molecules, amino acids, deoxyribonucleic acid, adenine, cystosine, glucose, thymine, mitochondrions, a highly complex nucleus, coenzymes, glucose, and many other factors not understood. I'm sure, friend, that after examining the case of a human cell, even Sherlock Holmes himself was hesitant to say, "Elementary, my dear Watson." But the extreme complexity of the simple cell is not the only snag. Think of the difficulties under which the first organism or cell to evolve would have had to live and reproduce itself in a world entirely mineral, without a trace of organic matter, devoid of 1 ounce of soil, devoid of bacteria and all other microorganisms, the land barren sand or bare mud, and the water holding only atmospheric gases and mineral salts. I shouldn't like to be in the only cell in the world. Even more than this, Hans Gerson, professor of biochemistry at Chicago University, writes in his article on photosynthesis, British Encyclopedia, 1961, under the section Origin of Life, "The chlorophyll system is a highly complex structure which ceases to function whenever its compounds are damaged. Obviously, therefore," says Hans Gerson, "life cannot have started with that particular synthetic reaction which is its sole support. Thus, even supposing a universal unicellular organism was spontaneously generated, it must have been without the power to synthesize inorganic matter which is absolutely necessary for it to survive." A conclusion more annihilating to the evolution theory can hardly be imagined. Various schemes have been propounded to answer the riddle, as put forward by Dr. Bloom, how, when no life existed, did substances come into being which today are absolutely essential to living systems, yet can only be formed by those systems? No answer has yet been put forward. Under natural causes now operating, all living matter comes from other living matter. Omni vita ex vita, omnicellular ex cellular. This is a law to which no exception has ever been known. You say, "Dr. Y, go on." on the basis of the very natural causes and laws which uniformitarians themselves invoke, their theory stands condemned. Obviously, it's only a dogma which is held by these men, not because it can be proved or is reasonable, but because the holders do not wish to acknowledge God. But bypassing these barriers, predicating that abiogenesis must have taken place in the remote, dim, misty and mystifying past, even if impossible now, men go on endeavouring to support their unscientific hypothesis. They advance the so-called proofs that all the innumerable complex forms of life originated from a single-celled ancestor. Before we deal with these, I'd like to remind you, friends, that if the foundations are rotten, and they are in this case, the so-called supporting evidences are of no value, and indeed will be found to be themselves more than doubtful. When I was at Geelong Grammar School and Melbourne University, these proofs were about 7. They're still taught in the textbooks and on the radio. I've checked that. And even in university circles, though quite a number of them are questioned and some of them abandoned by really advanced specialists in the branches of science concerned. I shall mention one or two of these. The first proof is comparative anatomy, or classifications of organisms. Although plants and animals can be arranged artificially in a series of seemingly increased complexity, that is not a proof that the higher ones have been evolved from the lower ones. Dr. Otzin Clark of the U.S. National Museum writes, "It is almost invariably assumed that animals with bodies composed of one cell represent the primitive animals from which all others were derived. They are commonly supposed to precede all other types in their appearance. There is not the slightest basis for this assumption, beyond the circumstances that in arithmetic, which is not zoology, the number one precedes the others. There is not the slightest evidence that any one of the major groups arose from another. Each is a special animal complex, related more or less closely to all the rest, and appearing, therefore, as a special and distinct creation. It is an absurd proof in any case, for it assumes the thing which is to be proved." And T.H. Morgan, you all know him from his experiments of Drosophila melanogaster, the well-known biologist and evolutionist, admits that there's no proof at all, and says that when the fallacy of the argument is pointed out to pupils of his who believe in evolution, they are very resentful. The next so-called proof, friends, is embryonic recapitulation. We won't waste much time on this one. According to this so-called law, every animal during gestation, that is in its mother's womb, climbs its own genealogical tree. This was Haeckel's idea. And as Dr. Thompson points out, he forged the evidence to support it. There are two fatal objections to this hypothesis which any unintelligent person can understand. The first is that it does not apply to the embryonic development of plants. Now this is inexplicable if recapitulation be a law of nature, and if, as evolutionists believe, plants and animals are descended from a common ancestor. Then the one-celled stage, the many-cell stage, between these one-cell and many-cell stages, every embryo passes through a 2-cell, 4-cell, 8-cell, 16, 32, 64, 128-cell stage. These, while mechanically essential, cannot represent ancestral stages, for no animal or plant, living or extinct, is composed of 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, or 64 cells. Thus the recapitulation theory comes to grief almost from the outset. The human embryo, friends, before the end of the second month, resembles a human embryo and nothing else. This theory has been abandoned at the top. Hans Dreyfus in the British Encyclopedia, in his article Embryology, writes, When we come to look for the facts on which it is based, we find they are non-existent. It is purely a deduction from the evolution theory, and even less than that. Professor Westall, before the British Association in 1951, called it sheer nonsense. And Dr. James Oppenheimer, and this is very up to date, of Brian Moore College, has stated that a number of embryologists now question whether attacks on the recapitulation theory are any longer necessary. Certainly a number of recent textbooks, while they may still describe the doctrine, refute it at the same time. And there seem to be increasingly fewer which labour it as tenable. This is in Science, January 2nd, 1959. Now we come to the geological record. The theory of evolution must stand or fall as the evidence of the fossils is for it or against it. Every other kind of evidence is subsidiary, can only confirm or strengthen the testimony of the fossils. It cannot invalidate them. But as Dewar says, the fossils are hostile witnesses. Not a single fossil of vital importance has come to light. And in our discussion here, we follow the age of the rocks accepted by evolutionary geologists. The first fossils appear in the Cambrian layer. They appear suddenly, as it were, with no ancestors. They appear already rigidly in their respective groups, with all the characters which distinguish the groups to which they belong, and there are no fossils linking them with other groups. In the Cambrian age, there are found so many orders and families that it is estimated that more than two-thirds of evolution was over when it was laid down. So that at least two-thirds of living creatures, no possible ancestors of any kind, have been found, for there are no undisputed pre-Cambrian fossils. If, as evolutionists assert, all these creatures were developed from a simple organism to man, some remains of these earlier forms should and would have been preserved. Then in this layer, and the others too, not one of the countless transitional intermediary forms necessary for the theory have been found. These transitional forms ought to outnumber the true species by 100 to 1, according to Darwin himself. No fossils have been discovered which unite one subkingdom with another. The earliest animals known belong to one or other of the types. So much so that Paulin says, the condition of the geological record shrieks out the most emphatic refutation of Darwin's doctrine of natural selection. The record is a tabula rasa in the matter of intermediate forms. Here let me say that it is not only the Cambrian, which is found next to the basal rocks. The youngest so-called rocks may lay at the bottom of a formation. Indeed, rocks of all ages, the so-called geological column, is a pure fiction. It only exists in the minds of historical geologists. If a pile were to be made by using the greatest thickness of the sedimentary bands of each geological age, it would be at least 100 miles high. Of course, it is impossible to have even a fraction of this at one place. This is taken from von Eglen's and Tillith Cass's Geology, page 417. Professor Enoch, fellow of the Zoological Society, of whom I was in correspondence about this matter, writes, "Nowhere on earth does such a column exist, and there is no spot where more than two or three systems are found one above the other. The thickness of the stratified rocks in any place varies from less than 1 foot to a few thousand feet, and the layers are fifteen layers are never found in the order proposed by evolutionary geologists. And now I'm quoting from Professor Edmund Speaker, writing in Mountain Building and Chronology and the Nature of Geological Timescale in the Bulletin of the American Association of Petrogeologists in 1956. He says, does our timescale then partake of natural law? He's a geologist. No. I wonder how many of us realize that the timescale was frozen in its present form by 1840. How much of the world geology was known in 1840? A bit of Western Europe, none too well, a lesser fringe of Eastern North America, all of Asia, Africa, South America, and most of North America were virtually unknown. How dared the pioneers assume that their scale would fit the rocks in these vast areas, by far the most of the world? Only in dogmatic assumption, a mere extension of the kind of reasoning developed by Werner from the facts in his little district of Saxony. And in many parts of the world, notably in India and South America, it does not fit. But even there it is applied. The followers of the founding fathers went forth across the earth and in Procrustean fashion made it fit the sections they found, even in places where the actual evidence literally proclaimed denial. These are not my words. Listen to this last sentence. So flexible and accommodating are the facts of geology. That's what Professor Edmund Speaker says. And one geologist writes, I have in my file 500 cases that attest to the reverse order, that is, the so-called simpler forms of life resting on the top of the more complex. It is therefore not true, as often stated, as I said before, that the fossils only occur in a definite and regular sequence. Now, to conclude this section, we quote from Dr. Herbert Nilsson, Professor of Botany at the University of Lund, Sweden, and admittedly one of the world's greatest authorities on genetics. Hear what he has to say. Speaking of fossil flora, he says, if we look at the peculiar main groups of the fossil flora, it is quite striking that at definite intervals of geological time, they are all at once and quite suddenly there. Moreover, in full bloom in their manifold forms. Furthermore, at the end of their existence, if they are extinct, they do not change into forms which are transitional towards the main types of the next period. Such are entirely lacking. This all stands in as gross a contradiction to the evolutionary interpretation as can possibly be imagined. There is not even a caricature of an evolution. This is synthetisch Art Buldinger. Pardon, correct me if I'm wrong, 1954. I assert, therefore, that the fossils and their positions in the earth strata give evidence hostile to this theory. Then there are blood precipitation tests. The contradictions and discrepancies of this method render its value as a proof of evolution essentially nil. The factors of heredity, in any case, do not lie in the blood, serum, but in the germ cells. Now we come to vestigial organs. I doubt very much if any embryologist or physiologist would be so rash as to say that any organ of the human body was a useless vestige. The last I had quoted to me was the pineal body. But listen to what Purvis Stewart's textbook of nervous diseases said on the subject. Purvis Stewart, page 68, 21st edition, 1952. Pronarium, Epiphysis cerebri. The pineal body was formerly regarded as a vestigial organ. So far from being a vestigial organ, a mere biological relic, The pineal body is an organ whose activity during a phase of its development has an important influence on normal metabolism by its action on the thalamus and thence on the hypophysis. With regard to the plica semilunaris, here I'm on my own ground because this I'm an ophthalmic surgeon, it is frequently stated that the plica semilunaris in man is a vestige of the nictitating membrane or third eye, which is found in birds, reptiles and mammals. But Professor E.P. Stebbs of the University of Liverpool has shown that structurally and functionally the plica of man and mammals differs entirely from the nictitating membrane of birds. And I testify, as an ophthalmic surgeon, that it's a highly useful structure in cleaning the eye. Sixthly, there's development of new forms, mutations. Very much against evolution. There is mutation within the species, but no transmutation. As one expert remarks, all mutations are bad, and the chance mutation theory of evolution is unsound. Professor Beck ridicules the idea that chance mutations can serve as a basis for evolution, even though there was one favorable mutation in 500. This idea would have us believe that if we wished to reach the North Pole, we could do so by taking one step northward and 500 southward. Professor C.P. Morton of McGill says, mutations are of the nature of injuries and to some extent impair the viability and fertility of the affected organisms. Professor R.A. Fisher says, the explanatory content of a theory of evolution only reached absolute zero with the mutation theory. In any case, Dr. Harold Bloom has demonstrated that mutations are controlled by the thermodynamic properties of the system and are not, therefore, the result of chance at all. Dr. W.R. Thompson says in this introduction of mutations, they are in general useless, detrimental, and lethal. And if left to nature in the wild, they would never survive. That's a poor foundation, friends, on which to build a vast system of evolution from amoeba to man. Now we come to anthropology. Well, that's the science of man, of course. The evidence here has been manipulated, and as all the public are aware now, through the Piltdown forgery, even faked. Sir Arthur Keith's writing of the Calaveras and Castelnaudono skulls says, where such discoveries in accordance with our expectations in regard to the date of man's evolution, no one would ever dream of doubting them, much less rejecting them. And he went on to say that numerous fossil skulls telling against the theory have been thrust into cupboards to await further investigation, which never takes place, and even destroyed. Here he is no doubt referring to the foxhole lower jaw found in the sand pit in Ipswich in 1863. This mysteriously disappeared, but a drawing published in the Anthropological Review of 1869 shows it to have been of a completely modern type. Here are some of the so-called missing links. Homo heidelbergensis, a single jaw. As a proof of evolution, it is admittedly completely worthless. Now we come to Pithecanthropus erectus duboisii. This name had already been given by Haeckel in 1868 to a hypothetical creature of a higher spiritual development than the anthropoids. Dr. Dubois believed that this creature existed and he went out to Java in 1891 determined to find it. And in 1891, he first discovered a molar tooth. Next month, he found a skull cap about 3 feet away from the place where he discovered the aforementioned tooth. A year later, in August 1892, he found a thigh bone about 50 feet from the spot where he had gathered the previous remains, and in October 1892, another tooth. 3 years later, he brought these bones to Europe to the Third International Congress of Zoologists, held in Zidane in Germany. He had a number of other specimens in his trunk, including two perfect skulls of Wajak man found in the same lair in the same vicinity, but he did not mention these. Dr. Workoff, the greatest anatomist of his day, publicly criticized Du Bois's report with the remark, found so far apart, there was no certainty that the bones belonged to the same creature. Other scientists examined them and could come to no definite conclusion. Dr. Du Bois took the huff and the bones and went back to Holland and kept them locked up for 26 years. And here Australia comes into the picture. Finally, in 1921, before he died, he admitted that he had found the two other skulls in exactly the same place, but only because in Australia the first fossil skull was discovered in 1921 when Professor Stuart A. Smith of Talgai, Queensland, arose claiming the find of the first man in Australia. The skulls, which Du Bois had found in the same lair that he found Pithecanthropus, were of Wajak man. And Wajak man had a far larger cranial capacity than any modern man. He also, Du Bois, changed his opinion about his original find and decided, finally, that Pithecanthropus was, after all, the skull of a giant gibbon. Now we come to Eoanthropus dorsonii, the piltdown skull. I don't need to tell you that this once highly lauded discovery about books, which vast books were written, turned out to be possibly the most unsavory scientific fake yet discovered. But I've something to say about this chap. He's been resurrected by Professor Houghton in 1958 in his book Up from the Apes. And he says simply because he must have a halfway state. However, we'll leave him buried, I hope. Hesperopithecus harrowcookii, the Nebraska man. An extremely significant name, friends, for if ever the evidence was cooked, which in this case, Hesperopithecus harrowcookii. Here really we do get on something very remarkable. Yes, this one is even more unsavory than the Piltdown skull. During the Dayton trial, William Jennings Bryan was publicly ridiculed by Clarence Darrow for not believing that a race of men 1 million years old had been discovered in Nebraska by a man called Harold Cook. This statement was confirmed in court by Professor Gregory and Professor Fairfield Osborne. What had Mr. Cook discovered in Nebraska? A single tooth. From this single tooth, a man-like ape was constructed from head to foot. Elliot Smith, I'm ashamed to say, an Australian, even persuaded the Illustrated London News to publish a full-page drawing of Mr. Hesperopithecus harrowcookii. A subsequent expedition actually discovered the very skull from which this tooth was taken. It proved to belong to an extinct species of pig, the peccary. Exit Mr. Hesperopithecus harrowcookii. Perhaps you are waiting for me to speak of Dr. Leakey's discoveries in South Africa, notably Zinjanthropos. What a suitable name that Dr. Leakey has for a man whose theories, as we shall see, do not hold water. It would take a long time to deal with these, but I do know that Dr. Leakey assigned this creature an honored position in man's direct ancestry in 1959. All these facts can be got from the numbers of the National Geographical magazine of America. if you don't want to go to the scientific publications. Volumes have been written on Mr. Zinjanthropos. Full-length pictures of him are published. But unfortunately for these artists, Dr. Leakey has now changed his mind. And Zinjanthropos has been demoted to the status of a non-human vegetarian of low intelligence and not a toolmaker at all. This is in Time, April 24, 1964. However, Dr. Leakey has now promoted another gentleman to his position. This is Mr. Homo habilis. Meet Homo habilis, gentlemen. We cannot spend much time on this gentleman, because most other observers are very cautious about his humanity. In fact, the Cambridge anthropologists deny that he's human at all. In fact, I hear he too will soon be demoted, so don't put your trust too much in Mr. Homo habilis or any other candidate for your ancestral honours, friends. You'll lose him very soon. I would like to say very much, to say a few words on the Hutu skull, the fishhook skull, the Galilee skull, the Malta jaw and parietal bone, most of which I have myself seen in various museums. But friends, I would like to here read something on the Pekin Man. I had looked up a lot of data about the Pekin Man, but it was so vast that it would take a lecture itself, so I decided to cut it out. But I found only today in a pamphlet by the Reverend Patrick O'Connell on this subject a very short account of the Pekin Man. And as the Reverend gentleman was in China when these events were taking place, I think it might be said that it's straight from the horse's mouth. This is what he writes. The Pekin, the Piltdown and Pekin men belong to the class of pure frauds. This is the due acknowledgement to the Reverend Patrick O'Connell. Belong to the case of the class of pure frauds. The difference between the two cases being that whereas in the Piltdown case no public money was sought or obtained, in the Pekin case a grant amounting to $280,000, equivalent to £100,000, was obtained from the Rockefeller Institute to excavate the limestone hill in which the fossils were supposed to be. The American people were never told what the excavations revealed. The present writer was in China while the excavations were being carried out and in a position to give the facts of the case, which are as follows. A few thousand years ago, quarrying of limestone in burning was carried out at this place, and lime burning was carried out at this place 37 miles from Pekin. In the course of time, the hill was undermined, and a great landslide occurred, which covered everything under thousands of tons of limestone. With the aid of the Rockefeller grant, the debris was removed, and beneath it was found an enormous heap of ashes, at the bottom of which were thousands of stones which had been brought from a distance. In the ashes were found a number of skulls of monkeys. Dr. Black, who represented the Rockefeller Institute, constructed a model which purported to represent one of these skulls, but which actually did not. He published a 100-page booklet describing the model and was made a fellow of the Royal Society. Just when he got the title, the bones of 10 real men who had been entombed in the landslide were brought into his laboratory at Pekin, and Dr. Black fell dead amongst them. Dr. Wiedenreich, who succeeded Dr. Black, concealed the finding of these bones for 5 years not 26 years, as Dr. Du Bois did, but for 5 years, and finally admitted it. There was no Pekin man at all in the sense claimed. The fossil skulls of the monkeys and the human skulls were not removed by the Japanese, as has been alleged. They were destroyed by the Chinese in order to remove the evidence of fraud. All the artifacts found and two artificial models, one made by Black and the other made by Weidenreich, have been preserved, are on show in Peking as evidence that the human race has been evolved from apes. I think, friends, I didn't put it too strongly when I said the evidence has been manipulated and even faked. Friends, I'd like to say a lot more about some of these skulls, but we haven't got time. But it is in Palestine, where I lived all those years, we have the best demonstration that prehistoric man were all of one species. For the Carmel, Palaeanthropos, Palestinensis individuals proved to be represent a mixed race, intermediate between Palaeanthropic man, that's Homo neanderthalensis, and Neanthropic man, Homo sapiens. This is Professor Albright writing. It would appear that Homo sapiens came to Europe from the southeast, driving Neanderthal man before him and interbreeding with the conquered foe at the same time. I've just returned from Jordan and I've seen these skulls in the Jerusalem Museum. And Dr. Albright goes on, it is an error, therefore, to label the principal types of prehistoric man as different species. Only one true type of genus Homo has hitherto been discovered. And finally, friends, the absolute interdependence of organic and inorganic nature, demonstrated in the oxygen cycle, the phosphate cycle, the nitrogen cycle, the photosynthetic properties of chlorophyll, show that nature began as a perfectly balanced system. Not only so, but in the field of organic nature, the marvelous symbiotic relations whereby species in the animal kingdom are dependent for their existence and persistence on species in the vegetable kingdom and vice versa, demonstrates that their appearance must have been practically simultaneous. Examples of this are well known, the pronubium moth and the yucca plant, the red clover and the bumblebee, and many others. And it is, of course, common knowledge that but for the presence of our birds, insects would multiply so quickly that in the course of a few months, they would destroy their own food and ours. Finally, let me quote from Grant Watson, The Story of the Butterfly and the Ant. This is what he writes. The caterpillar of the large blue, Macrolinia arica, feeds on the flowers of wild thyme for 3 weeks. It then falls from the plant and starts wandering. Soon it meets a red ant. The caterpillar pillar has a special gland on the tenth segment, which exudes honey dew. The ant strokes this and eats the exudation. The caterpillar, by the way, responds only to the ant's caress. After a time, prompted by some unexplained mystic sympathy, the caterpillar prepares itself to be carried off. It gives the signal by assuming an extraordinary attitude, swelling up the thoracic segments, and carried to the ant's nest. It is fed by the ants on their own larvae. It then pupates, crawls out, and finally flies away. How was such a creature evolved? Is it conceivable to imagine such a sequence of adaptations as a result of small continuous variations? Did the honey paw spring into existence as a mutation? And if so, did the disposition to drop from the food plant synchronize with the organ and origin of this mysterious organ? When did the first ant meet the first caterpillar? And did the first caterpillar hunch itself up into a convenient shape to allow the ant to carry it off without too much trouble? Or were these habits learned by practice and perfected through generations of experience? Why do the ants hold their hands, or rather their jaws, to spare the hapless butterfly as it crawls through their tunnels that under other circumstances they would devour? Are all these characteristics so firmly established, so definite, to be explained by calling them fortuitous mutations? Does that really mean anything? Will any of the classical theories of evolution explain this sequence in the life of the large blue? The answer is no. If evolution fails here, it fails everywhere. For it is put forward as a universal principle. I submit, therefore, friends, that the hypothesis of evolution is erroneous, and its dominance an obstacle to the pursuit of science. And that though belief in special creation may be founded primarily in belief in him for whom all things were made, and without him for whom nothing was made that is made, is a perfectly reasonable faith, and far more in harmony with the facts of science than is the hypothesis of evolution. Thank you, friends, for listening so nicely to me. That's all I have to say.
Gentlemen, I believe we have enough questions here to start the ball rolling. Right. Question number one, just like a quiz, isn't it? But there are no jackpot prizes. Well, Doctor, the first question is, does not the vermiform appendix, or appendix vermiformis to you as a medical man, show that evolution has made an unnecessary organ in the human body?
That's right up my street. I am sorry Professor R.J.A. Berry, Professor of Anatomy at Melbourne University, is not here to answer that. Dickie Berry. He was only about 5'1", but he was an atomic bomb. And that question used to be asked him. Dickie was a very strong evolutionist, but he used to devote one lecture every year to the subject of the vermiform appendix with slides. And his opinion, which was forcibly expressed, was that the vermiform appendix is an exceedingly important lymphatic organism in youth and should never be removed, excepting it's under very definite cases where it would endanger life. He had the slightest doubt that it was an important organ in early youth, just the same as the tonsils are, a lymphatic gland. And I doubt very much, friends, our friend who answered that, asked that question, if there's anybody who really knows anything about physiology of man who would say that the vermiform appendix is a vestigial organ. That's all I can say it, friends. But personally, and that was what I was taught by Richard Berry, and of course I've seen it in other, should never be removed, excepting under circumstances which make it absolutely necessary. We used to whip out the tonsils like nothing on earth. I remember when I was resident at Launceston General Hospital in the First War in 1915. I look back with very much regret on those lymphatic organisms I whipped out of poor children, and I should certainly never do it again.
Well, now the second question is, of what scientific repute Are those quoted in your addresses, did they in general either support or object to the hypothesis of evolution?
Well, friends, I tried to show that these men were all of scientific repute. Professor Spiker, for example, of geology, Dr. W.R. Thompson, Sir James Jeans. In fact, I don't think I mentioned anybody who could be even, shall we say, claimed to be an amateur. If anybody remembers one, I should be very pleased to hear it. And then, did they in general either support or object to the hypothesis of evolution? Quite a number of them, friends, didn't object to it. In fact, they supported it. But of course, it's not the what a man, it's the facts that we were dealing with, not the conclusions which these men came to. And if one can quote a recognized authority on geology, whose facts tell against evolution, one has every right to do so, no matter what he believes. And the questioner is quite right, quite a large number of these men believed in evolution. Dr. Thompson, for example, I don't think would say that he was an anti-evolutionist. Dr. Herbert Wilson, perhaps would.
Here,
but this is Kerkoot's book in the International Series of Monographs on Pure and Applied Biology. Now, Kerkoot gives a very vague and general adherence to the doctrine of evolution, which he, in this book, proceeds to absolutely disintegrate. I recommend it to students of biology. It's called The Implications of Evolution. And it's in the International Series of Monographs on Pure and Applied Biology. So, friends, it's perfectly true, of course, a large number of these fellows believed in evolution. But I was using their facts and also their quotations in a perfectly legitimate manner, I feel, and if anybody can find one of these men who is not a recognized authority, I should be very pleased to hear it. And that's all I would say about that one, friends.
Thank you very much. Well, now here's another one. Could you explain how God made the world? And if not, why should you criticize others who try?
I think, friends, that's pretty difficult. You see, the word creation means, as is acknowledged, bara, in all the Hebrew dictionaries, to make something out of nothing. To make something without the use of pre-existing materials. Well now, friends, I don't know how anybody could explain an act which makes something out of not pre-existing materials. But I can say that with regard to man, the Lord Jesus Christ, and don't forget this, don't blame me for bringing this in, you follow me? The Lord Jesus Christ, during his lifetime, on one occasion, took 5 loaves and 2 small fishes, and fed 5,000 men, and at least 5,000 women and children. And knowing Palestine very well as I do, I know that to satisfy the appetite for bread of a man would at least 1 pound, and probably more. So that by the time the Lord Jesus Christ had finished, from those 5 loaves there were about 7 tons
of bread and about a ton of fish. I asked myself, Christ and God cannot explain how he made something out of nothing, but he can demonstrate it. And I believe that that and other similar miracles demonstrate how God made something out of nothing. I'm afraid I can't answer that question. I don't know how God did it. But I know it was done. And especially in the case of Jesus Christ, who was God, and by whom, without whom, was not anything made that was made. Is there anything else in that one?
Well, it says, why should you criticize others who try to make this explanation?
Friends, you put it on me, criticizing. I say that these men are criticizing me, if you only put it. The French have a proverb, cet animal est très méchant, comme il est attaqué, il se défend. This animal is very wicked. When it is attacked, it defends itself. That's my wickedness.
Now here's one probably from a science student with a capital S. Given the probability of the production of one specific amino acid and a protein, consequently maybe of the order of 10 to the 275th power, could this probability not be accommodated by time, taking into consideration the number of molecular collisions that would occur in the primordial sea?
And that was that. Well now, friends, this is a very important question. I think my friend must be quoting from the Comte de Noy about the 10 to the 275th power. But listen, friends, I tried to make out as best as I could that it's perfectly true that with all the laboratory conditions which we now have at our disposal and passing electrical discharges and that sort of thing under artificial conditions, we have produced one amino acid. But I tried to point out, friends, that in the human cell, or any other cell, there's not one amino acid, there are scores of them. And not only amino acids, many other bodies, but take the amino acids alone. These amino acids, supposing, friends, it were possible to synthesize a molecule of protein. And now we're a long, long way off it, I must say, as our friend rightly says. Suppose it were possible under our conditions to do so. That wouldn't make the thing alive. The naturalist Fabre, the famous and most, I suppose, naturalist in the world, Henri Fabre, in his book, what is called Social Life in the Insect World, says, in the course of his discussion, I hear that people say that they are going to be able to synthesize protoplasm. He said, well, what will that mean? It's pretty sarcastic, these Frenchmen. He says we shall have a slimy mess which will immediately go bad and put out a horrible stink. It's his own words, my friend, not mine. And he said, have they got at the end of their syringe that spirit that will put life into it? And Henri Fabre ridicules the idea. I personally think that not this probability, the age, as I was talking to a friend down there, the age of the cosmos is only estimated at 5
thousand million years, and the enormous time which it would take to synthesize one amino acid, and it doesn't need one, it means hundreds in this primeval soup. That's a wonderful soup, friends. I would suggest to our abiogenesis that they took their theme song from Alice in the Wonderland. Soup, soup, beautiful soup, soup of the evening, beautiful soup. And I don't think it's possible. There's no time for it, even supposing it were. Did occur. But there's not the slightest evidence that it occurs in nature. These are artificial conditions of the most strenuous type. But even if it did, at that speed, all the time there is, and there are only 5,000 billion years, would not be sufficient to synthesize enough proteins to make even one cell, it seems to me. That's the way I look at it. If that gentleman will stay afterwards, we'll be able to discuss it more on, you know, technical lines. It's in here, it's in Kirkcood. I'm sorry I wasn't able to make it more easy, friends.
Well, now, here's an... Do you believe in the 6 days of creation? And do you consider these days were 24 hours in length?
Well, friends, we started this out as a lecture on evolution, not on creation. Well, I'm quite willing to tackle it, friends, because it's a subject that's up my street. First of all, the Bible never says that the earth was created in 6 days. As one of our friends that I was talking about there, the Bible says, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. So that before the 6 days began, all the cosmos was in existence, the solar system, the planets, and everything was there. Because if the earth was in existence, of course the planets were in existence. And the sun and the moon was in existence. And then when the 6 days begin, you only get the word create, that is, to make out of nothing, 3 times. One with regard to plants, the other animals, land animals, sea animals, and man. That's the only time when it's said to create something out of nothing. All the other times it is said God made the sun to rule by day and the moon to rule by night.